it's a, essentially what I'm wanting to do in this series of talks, really two things. One is to give a kind of description of the liberating path, to give some idea about what actually happens to people when they do spiritual practice in this tradition. It's kind of a roadmap of liberation. But I also would like for us to be able to practice right in the midst of our lives the subjects that we've been talking about. So last week was the subject was ascent, A-S-C-E-N-T. It was about joy. This week is about descent, pain. And we'll have a couple more talks. I'd like to just come back to the most fundamental principle, just to sum up a little bit where we've come, and then I've asked people to actually, in this intervening week, to practice what we were talking about last week and to share. So I hope someone will have enough courage, or a bunch of people will have enough courage to share what has happened. But I think it's really important, one, for us to keep it really simple, and two, to be clear about why we're doing this. Why are we doing a liberating practice? And the reason we're doing it is because of a central, absolutely important insight that the Buddha had. He understood that it isn't what happens to us. It's not the circumstances of our lives that cause our happiness or our suffering. It's how we relate to or respond to our experience. Now, I know that sounds abstract, but if you actually understand only that one thing, you can free yourself. So it's not the lung cancer that's causing your suffering. We believe it is. It's not the breakup of an important relationship in your life which is causing your suffering. It's not the toxic relationship with your boss that's causing your suffering. It's not the pain in your knee that's causing your suffering. It's how you relate to or respond to it. Do you see how liberating that is? As long as we believe that what is happening to us is going to either cause our happiness or our pain, then we are buffeted about because we don't have control over what happens to us. We get blown this way and that way. But as soon as we are actually we know it's how I respond, then suddenly we're enormously empowered. Does that make sense? It's so important. So the Buddha said that the reason we suffer, you know, he also said, he said there's only one subject worth talking about, and that's the only subject we'll be talking about in these four talks. It's the only subject I ever talk about. He said there's only one subject worth dealing with, and that is suffering and how we can overcome it. So if you have no suffering in your life, and if you don't know anybody who suffers, this is probably the wrong place for you. So let's be clear about what the stakes are here. The stakes are extraordinarily high. The stakes are whether you will have a happy life or a miserable life. What can be more important or fundamental than that? As you master your mind and heart, and you learn to respond more and more skillfully to your experience, you're free. So the Buddha said, what causes our suffering is that we like pleasant experience and we don't like unpleasant experience. Is there anyone here who disagree with that? You know, we like pleasure. We like what feels good. And because we like it, we grab for it and we try to hold on to it. Everything is impermanent. It doesn't work. It doesn't work to try to hold on to anything because everything passes away. And so we suffer. And we don't like unpleasant experience, so we try to keep it away, and if we have it, we try to get rid of it. and it's that resistance that causes our suffering. And then the Buddha said there's even a more fundamental cause for our suffering, and that is that we believe we're separate. And as long as we think that we're separate, then we've got something to gratify with pleasure and something to defend with pushing away unpleasant experience. So those are the causes of our pain and suffering. And the Buddha said if you don't like your unhappiness or your suffering, then remove the causes. And it's actually possible to do that with our spiritual practice. So it isn't pleasure that causes us, that gets us into trouble. I think that's a very deep misconception about Buddhism and within Buddhism. It's not pleasure. It's actually our grasping for and trying to hold on to pleasure. Suffering equals pleasure plus grasping and clinging. Suffer equals pain plus resistance. Pain does not ever cause our suffering. It's our resistance to the pain that causes our suffering. So really, that's what all of this is about. That's what these talks are about. So last week, I talked about forms of happiness that we can experience. And I talked about first about the transpersonal journey or our spiritual practice. That the first aspect of our spiritual practice is ethical conduct, to really make a commitment to do no harm. And when we do harm, to forgive ourselves, to make amends, and to keep practicing. And the more you practice that, the better you get. And as our speech and action become more purified, then it's possible to purify the mind through meditation. The Buddha said, do good, avoid doing harm, and purify your mind through and heart through meditation. And so I described that the first task of a meditator is to tranquilize the mind and heart. Calm is a wonderful form of happiness. You know, which would you rather have, anxiety or calm? And if you train your mind to be more one-pointed, to be less distracted, more on target in terms of staying with whatever object like the breath. If you do that enough, if you're just present enough, your mind will become calm. And then there will be a sense of ease. There will be a sense of being at ease. And then there are deeper forms of happiness as concentration deepens yet further. Of rapture, of a kind of delighted or joyous response to our experience, the oh wow that we all know, and bliss, which is a kind of even deeper, contented, calm form of happiness. And then what I suggested is that we actually pay attention to our experience in this week. And what I suggested we do is, one, to pay attention to pleasure, to pleasant experience, and see where we get caught in terms of grasping and clinging. And see if it's possible, and this for me has been an absolutely delightful practice for decades now. Just one correction about the introduction. I've been teaching since 1985. I've been practicing quite a bit longer. Essentially what I've learned to do is to enjoy pleasant experience, those chocolate things at Trader Joe's. Truffles. Chocolate truffles. Has anyone ever had those chocolate truffles? Okay. You know, it's very pleasant. And if it's possible to respond to the chocolate truffle as you eat it, to be very present, to be very aware, to know that it's pleasant, to enjoy the pleasure of it, it's possible actually to have a response of rapture, of delight in the experience. And if the experience, if you're really present for it, and you're not obsessed with thinking, and you're not thinking about something else, and if you're not all caught up in something else, but you're really there for the experience of the truffle, the experience is so complete, you don't need another one. It can be that simple. Then you don't grasp. Then you don't cling. Then you don't get caught up in addiction. It's very simple. So paying attention to our experience of pleasure and how we respond to it. and seeing if it's possible to shift our response. And then I also suggested that we really pay attention to celebrate goodness wherever we find it, in ourselves or in others, in this intervening week. Every moment of love, every moment of kindness, every moment of generosity, every moment of gratitude. And I gave some examples from my own life of where I have made a decision in my own life that whenever I see goodness, whenever I see a beautiful quality in someone, I not only will acknowledge that to myself, but I'll acknowledge it out loud to the other person. What sustains us is connection. You know, we are so separating. We Americans particularly, we separate, we separate, we separate, we isolate. And what sustains us is feeling connected. And this business of seeing goodness. You know, the Buddha said, loving kindness, true love, is seeing goodness in beings and wishing for their well-being. That sense of seeing goodness allows us to be connected. And so, you know, I try to live my life in such a way that every being I meet is my friend, and I try to relate to them as a friend. And it really has been quite wonderful. So, with that introduction, I asked you, for those of you who were here last week, to come back and report what happened. Anybody who would like to share what happened? Come on, don't be brave. Nobody saw any goodness in the class week. Nobody saw a single act of generosity or kindness. Nobody was compassionate in response. Okay, go for it.
My name is Nell, and I had lunch with a substitute teacher at my school today. Sometimes the substitute teachers are kind of isolated because they're not hanging by the other side. And I started talking to her, and she said that she had lost her job as a chemist. And, you know, we were just kind of talking about job interests and, you know, just kind of getting to know you kinds of things. But it came out that she had lost her job as a chemist because she had been a whistleblower about improper disposal of toxic substances that were happening at her place of work. And I wasn't thinking about the homework, but I did have sort of a feeling rise in me of how brave of this person. And I'm very glad that I told her that, too. I thought, you know, she's lost her job. Here she is on the substitute teacher circuit and with an uncertain future. And I just decided to give her some encouragement, and it felt really good.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks so much. Anyone else?
This is very, very simple. I was at the doctor's office, and you know, you go and you have to pay your deposit, and this lady who was handling all the medical forms had a mountain of paperwork behind her, and I said to her, "Oh, you are so busy and you are so swamped, aren't you?" And she looked at me as if nobody had ever said that to her, and she was just beaming, and I felt so good that I made her feel special because of her work. But really, you know, the gift was to me because she made me feel good about myself that I recognized her. That's it.
My younger sister has my mother living with her, and it's very challenging. She's very old, and she has dementia. And I'm here and there. So I said to her that I was very grateful that she was doing this, and that I thought she should feel really good about herself. I said exactly what Eric said last week. She should feel a lot, very good about what she's doing. And it was really cool. It was like, I can't do certain things for them, but I can tell that she felt good that I said that to her.
Beautiful. Thank you. Got one over here. You got...
I have an elderly neighbor across the street. She's about 92, and I know she doesn't hear very well. And she's so independent. She's so bright and with it. And I saw this man with his pickup truck in front of her house this week, and I figured that he seemed he was at her door, and I could see he was leaving a note or something, and I knew that she probably had not heard the doorbell. So I went out, and I asked him if he were wanting to see her or something, and he said, yeah, he was there to do a roof estimate. So I told him, well, she's not going to hear you probably, and don't leave, but let me call her just a minute. So I called her, and she was very surprised and glad, and such. Because I know that, you know, it's so hard to catch up with those guys when you're calling them estimates. And bless her heart, at 92, she was taking on that responsibility to negotiate. She probably was going to have several estimates. So anyway, I helped her out, and I just felt really good about that. I caught the man before he left, and they had a nice long meeting, as far as I could tell.
Thank you.
Where am I going? Did you see? There's somebody over here.
Right, you're on. Oh, here, I see a hand in the back. Here we go.
About a week ago, she ran up to another man who was walking in the park, and he was obviously terrified. She's very friendly, but he totally freaked out, and I called her back and kind of went away ashamed. And this weekend, I walked her, and I saw him coming along next to me, and I called my dog to myself and put her leash on, waved at him, and kept him walking.
Thank you. Thanks. I'd like to share just one instance of something that has happened to me in this past week. It was actually this morning. I gave a talk in Santa Fe on Tuesday evening, and to save myself a whole bunch of extra driving, I spent two nights with friends. Many of you may know of Doug Booth from the Santa Fe Sangha. I stayed with him and his partner, Lyra. Doug is the founder of the Heart Mountain Prison Project, taking spiritual practice into prisons in New Mexico. And I think Valerie's here this evening, aren't you? Valerie Roth? Yes, Valerie actually works with Heart Mountain Prison Project and goes into the prisons. By the way, they need more teachers. So if you have an established practice, you might talk to Valerie. They could use you if you're willing to do that work. But Doug this morning told me a story of someone with whom he has been working for many years in one of the prisons, and it's someone who really deeply took to the practice and has been very seriously doing this liberating practice in prison for several years now. And has really made progress with the work. And he's been in prison for over 30 years. And he's up for parole next year. And Doug said that he and his partner, Lyra, are planning to offer him a place to live because he will have been coming out of prison after more than 30 years in prison. They've offered him to stay with them up near Pecos until he gets his feet on the ground. It's a very beautiful gesture, and his response was very interesting. He said, you know, when I get out of prison, there's probably going to be a lot of publicity has been in prison for over 30 years because he murdered a famous heiress in Colorado in the 1970s. He said, there's probably going to be a lot of publicity and people are going to be following where I am, and I don't want that to hurt you and Lyra. And he said, I'll probably go to my to stay with my brother in Las Cruces for a while until things settle down, and then I'd really be happy to take you up on your offer. So you see the goodness in both of those people? You know, they're very, very considerate of each other and of their well-being. No, it's this may seem trivial, and yet it isn't. You know, essentially we are sustained by love. The Buddha said that the greatest healing power in the entire universe is loving kindness. That's what heals us. And so these examples of what may seem like very small things, but actually they accumulate over a lifetime. If you are making an effort to be kind, to be compassionate, to be helpful, to be generous, if you cultivate gratitude in your own heart, if you honor those who are good, you will find yourself in this enormous web of love that will sustain you through the hard times. If you really want to be miserable, isolate yourself. You know, and then when the hard times come, the support won't be there. That network of support won't be there. So it's significant. It's really important. So, as I warned last week, the second week is the downer week of dealing with pain. But it's equally important. Again, you know, our suffering comes from grasping for and clinging to what is pleasant, and because everything passes away, it's a sure setup, an absolutely sure setup for suffering. And our suffering also comes from resisting and pushing away pain. And I think it's very useful to really look and see what is it that keeps us from joy, for example, I mentioned last week, from forms of happiness. Well, it's mostly anxiety. When your heart is really anxious, it can't be joyful. Forms of fear and our obsession with thinking. You know, you really can't be there for a beautiful flower or a beautiful sunset or a beautiful Grand Canyon or a beautiful human being. You can't be there to really appreciate it. If your mind is somewhere else. We all know this. We've all had those experiences. What is it that keeps us from coming into a right relationship or a liberating relationship with pain? Denial and avoidance, I think, more than anything else. Our resistance, yes, I've already talked about that, our not wanting it, our trying to get rid of it, but it's also one key expression of our pushing away or not wanting to experience pain is the capacity for denial. You know, have you ever had the thought, I don't want to hear about it, I don't want to experience it? I can't tell you how many people have said to me, I'm afraid to meditate because I'm afraid of what's there. I'm afraid of what's going to come up. And essentially what I say to people is, yes, it will come up. If you do enough meditation, deep meditation, you go deep into the psyche, it's all going to come. But what happens is that we create a stronger and stronger mind and heart that can be a powerful container for holding whatever comes up. You know, essentially what happens is that most people, if they haven't really trained, if they haven't mastered their hearts and their minds, most people have a very, very narrow range of experience. They don't know the extraordinary forms of joy and happiness and bliss and ecstasy and the happiness of love and all the rest of it. They don't know that because they actually don't allow themselves to experience it. And And people also do not allow themselves to feel the whole range of pain. And essentially what happens as we do this practice is that we experience the whole thing. Just someone who's had an enormous impact on my life, I just want to share a short quotation from Helen M. Luke, who is a great Jungian psychoanalyst and a wonderful writer. And I'm quoting from her book, Old Age, Journey into Simplicity, which has had just a huge impact on my life in the last 15 years. Helen M. Luke said, she's going to use patriarchal language here, and so forgive her, she was born in 1904. So she's a product of her time. There is in man a fear of joy as keen as the fear of suffering pain, because true joy precludes the pleasant feeling of self-importance, just as suffering precludes all of the comforts of self-pity. I think that's just extraordinary. I think it's really true. When you are experiencing joy, and all of us have had that experience, just notice. Just notice in that moment of, whether there's self-importance. You know, the ego disappears in that moment. You know, if you pay close attention to it. And how do we relate to our pain? Well, you know, we're afraid of feeling our pain. We're afraid of actually relating skillfully to our pain because we like the comforts of self-pity. There's a wonderful line in I don't know if I have it here. Oh yeah, there's a wonderful line in one of Bob Dylan's early songs where he talks about a guy who celebrates his misery. Do you know anybody who celebrates their misery? You know, and do you notice how ego-creating that is? I'm important because I'm miserable. You know, so it's actually, if it's possible, you know, to come out of our denial, come out of our avoidance, and the critical thing about relating to pain is the willingness to turn toward it and to see it for just what it is. And it's again, this is a very simple thing to say, but it actually takes a lot of training for us to do it. As long as we're avoiding pain, we're in suffering, because as long as we're avoiding pain, we're in anxiety because we know it's there. You know, there's this the mind that suppresses is a very anxious mind because it's not relating to reality. It's running away from reality. Is it possible to train ourselves, when there is pain, to turn toward it and know it for what it is? And that, and this is, can be extraordinarily liberating. You know, the Buddha said that there are two great protections. One is awareness and the other is love. And if we can experience either emotional pain or physical pain, I'll talk first about physical pain. If we can experience physical pain, for example, for just what it is, if we can simply be aware of it and know it, then the mind is not reactive. It's not the pain that causes our suffering. It's how we're relating to it, it's the resistance to it. Now, yes, we would all prefer not to experience pain, but guess what? You know, if you're in a human body, it's going to happen. And if it's going to happen, how do we learn to work with it in such a way that we don't suffer with it? Let me just give you one little example of something that has happened to me just very recently. On Tuesday morning, I went to the hospital in Taos to have some blood drawn for tests, for lab tests. And I had to be fasting. And by the time I got to the hospital, I'd been fasting for 14 hours. And I have a blood sugar condition that isn't serious. I have hypoglycemia. So this body produces a little bit too much insulin, and so the blood sugar gets very low. And when the blood sugar is very low, I actually get confused and dizzy, and cognition is not working very well. I can't think very well. And so I went into the hospital. I was already pretty spacey, and then it took a long time for them to take me. And I realized, oh, I'm really getting pretty far out of it here. So I went up to the window at the lab, and I said, I have a blood sugar condition. My blood sugar is very low. Could you tell me how long it will be before you can take the blood? And they came out and rushed me in, you know, very compassionately. And the woman, the lab technician who was taking the blood, had her hand on my shoulder, and she was giving me reassurance. But by that time, I was pretty far gone. And I was responding to her. I was talking to her. I could still keep my eyes open, but I was just starting to go like this. And by the time she finished taking the blood, she kind of locked me into the chair that I was in, and she turned to another lab technician and said, stay with him. And then she literally ran out the room, to find some orange juice. And she came running back in with this orange juice, and she gave me this orange juice, which revived me just enough for me to drive to the nearest breakfast. But as I look back on that experience, that certainly was not a pleasant experience, but as I look back on that experience, I realized there was no suffering. I understood these are just conditions. It's just how this body responds. If I eat 4 or 5 times a day, I am perfectly fine. If I go without eating for too long, the blood sugar gets really low and I can lose consciousness. It was just conditions. There was no resistance to the experience. I've often told the story. Many of you have heard the story, and the reason I tell it over and over again is because it was so dramatic for me, is that a number of years ago I got shingles. And I didn't know what it was. I thought my back had gone out, and I went into the emergency room. But I was in this enormous pain in my back, just greater pain than I've ever experienced before. And the mind happened to be really strong. So I was just aware of pain, aware of pain. Aware of pain. There was no resistance. It was just being aware of it. It's just a condition. I knew that it was not me. I knew that it was not mine. I knew that it was just pain. And without resistance, I was just fine. And I went that way for maybe 10 or 12 hours, and then the mind got tired. And when the mind got tired, it wasn't powerful anymore. And as soon as the mind got tired with this intense pain, it started to get reactive. And I could just actually see the suffering creeping in. It was so interesting. It was fascinating. Yeah, I still knew the pain wasn't me or mine. But the mindfulness was not strong enough to hold it without resistance. And so, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I drove myself to the emergency room in the hospital, and I said, I'm in huge pain. Can you help me? And they gave me a painkiller. And then eventually they figured out that it was shingles. And so I was given a drug to basically stop the virus. But it was such a beautiful demonstration for me. It was such a beautiful demonstration that the pain did not cause suffering. It was the resistance. Does that make sense? And I think it's perfectly natural, because our conditioning is so strong, that if we experience pain, there's this thing of, I don't want this. And if you can see that response, I don't want this, and then step back for a moment and realize that you have a choice. You know, in this culture, we can relieve a lot of our pain. There are times when pain cannot be relieved. And so it's really useful for us actually to train ourselves, you know, so that we're really prepared to experience pain without reactivity. So there are times when you simply can't take the aspirin or whatever. And so if it's possible, when you see that I don't want this come up, which is a very kind of instinctive response, if you can catch it and say, wait a minute, I've got a choice here. If you can understand that central principle of the Buddha, it's not what happens to you that causes your happiness or your suffering. It's how you respond to relate to. And if we're reacting to with aversion, with pushing away, I will guarantee that there'll be suffering. And the confused or unconscious mind will believe that the pain is causing the suffering. It's not. It's the response in the heart. As soon as you catch it, you are profoundly empowered. Once you catch it, then you can make a choice. Am I going to go with this resistance, or am I going to try to let the resistance go and let the pain be just pain? She says, there's one experience in the body, physical pain, and then there's an experience in the mind, which is the relationship to it. And if you can distinguish between those two things, there's the physical experience and there's the mental experience, and you train your mind, you are giving yourself an enormous gift. And the more trained we are, the more adept we become, you know, the more practiced we become, it becomes possible more and more and more to not get caught in reaction. Just as we don't have to get caught in grasping and clinging for pleasant experience, it doesn't have to happen. You know, okay, it's pleasant. You know, you would rather not have your daughter die, you know? Or you would rather have that relationship, if it's a healthy relationship in your life, or you would rather not lose your partner, your intimate partner. You'd like to keep that pleasant experience. But if you can understand the antidote, you know, for attachment, clinging and attachment, which is what causes our suffering with pleasant experience, the Buddha said the antidote for that, what cuts through it, is the understanding of impermanence. Well, your daughter's going to die someday. And if you're lucky, you'll die before she does. You know? And your partner's going to be lost, for sure, either through estrangement or death. No other choice. Maybe you'll be lucky and die first. You know, but it is going to be impermanent. Anything that you treasure that's pleasant to you, that is important to you, anything is going to pass away. Whatever it is that's important to you, if it's your house or your car or your clothes or relationships, it will all pass. And as we come to understand that more and more deeply, what happens, and I can say that I'm speaking from my own experience here, is that when you know something is going to pass away, then you don't take it for granted and you show up for it. You know, it's I have a wonderful relationship with an intimate partner. And I have done enough of this practice to know that it can't last. I hope it will last for the rest of my life. But I know it can't last. And so there's a way in which when I'm with my partner, I can really, really show up, because I may never see him again. It's just the reality of it. And so I don't ever separate from my partner without saying, I love you. Because I don't want, you know, even if we're pissed with each other, if you'll forgive the term, it's still, I say, I love you, because I don't want the last contact not to be a loving one. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So understanding impermanence, and then essentially the antidote for working with a painful experience, like physical pain, is to understand that it's inevitable, and also to remember that it's impermanent. So, Have you ever had a painful experience, either a physical painful experience or an emotional painful experience? And have you ever, like depression, for example? And have you ever gotten caught in the delusion this is going to last forever? That's where the intense suffering comes from. When we forget impermanence and we think it's going to go on. You know? And if I can remember when I'm in physical pain or when I'm in emotional pain, if I can remember this is impermanent, this will pass away too. Do you see? Then it's easier for me not to be reactive, not to resist. So I talked about working with physical pain. It's also really important for us to work with emotional pain, because on some deep level, emotions tend to run our lives. It has been so liberating for me to understand that even the most intense emotional pain is workable and it's impermanent. If you know that fear is only fear, and again, many of you have heard me talk about this, but I think it's really helpful, and I'd like to suggest that we really work with this in this coming week. But with either the physical pain or with emotional pain, the first step is for us to identify it for what it is. You know, let's say grief. So there's been some big loss in your life, and there's a feeling of grief. So if that loss has happened, there's going to be a story about the grief, a story about the loss. There might well be a lot of self-pity. Oh, poor me, because I've lost this important relationship or this important possession or whatever in my life. So there may be a story. There may be self-pity involved. And then there's the actual, there's a story, and then there's the emotion itself. And when we're caught up in the story, essentially we're dealing with a secondary, something which is secondary, which is only an effect. When we're willing to come and deal with the emotion itself, let the story go and be with the emotional self, we're working at the causative level. That's where we can really free ourselves. So are we willing? If we're not willing to do that, and we've all had this experience, some powerful emotion that generates a story, and the story reinforces the emotion, and the emotion reinforces the story, which reinforces the emotion, and it can go on for years and years and years until we're willing to break that cycle. If we can separate out the story, yes, the story is going to keep coming back, but you basically say, no, I'm not giving my attention to that story. I want to be with the feeling. What does grief feel like in the body? You know, what does it feel like? There's a heaviness, isn't there? There are sensations, and tend to be sensations in this core part of the body here, in the torso. You know, can you actually be with those sensations and know that grief is just grief? To be with it. Let the story go, be with the sensations. This is the mindfulness part of it. And then there's another whole part of this practice, and that is it possible to touch this experience with kindness? Is it possible to love yourself feeling grief? Is it even possible to love the grief itself? You know, it's essentially love is a non-reactive emotion that allows things to happen. And it's that quality of allowing. Do you see that quality of allowing? It means that we've let go of the resistance, the pushing away. We've changed our response. We've changed our relationship to the experience. Is this too complicated? This is such essential information. It's really what can free us. Yes, please.
This brings up to me, my son died of AIDS.
Yeah.
and his partner came to live with us shortly thereafter. And we took care of him until he died on our divan.
Also of AIDS?
Yes. Yes. They had become skeletons by then.
Yeah.
And I know that there's a story to it, but I was a volunteer for New Mexico AIDS Services. And so I was seeing a lot of other young men dying of AIDS. It wasn't just my son and his partner, who we adored, but it was a huge community. And I don't know how to get rid of that story.
Right. If I may, I want to acknowledge how painful your experience has been. As far as I understand it, I am not myself a parent, but as far as I understand it, for a parent to lose a child in death is about the most painful thing that a human being can experience. So I just want to honor the pain and how great it is. I'd like to just suggest one thing, and this has been so helpful for me in terms of working with grief in my own life, is that in this society, we tend to confuse grief and love. We think if I'm grieving for someone, that I'm loving them. And actually, they're not the same thing. They're actually very different. Yes. Grief is a kind of aversion which resists change. It's perfectly natural, and it's really important for us to feel it and to engage it and to work with it. But essentially, it's resistance to a change that happens. What I've learned about love is that it knows nothing about change and death. If you love your son and his partner, that love has not changed because their bodies passed away. And this has been, my brother was a suicide, 38, almost 39 years ago now, and he was my best friend. And I was 26, he was 28. And what has been clear to me, that was the most difficult loss in my life. And what I've come to understand is that if I just remember the love for my brother, I know we're still absolutely connected. It's an active, living relationship. That may sound weird, but we are way connected, and I can feel the happiness of that connection. So if you can distinguish between grief and love, and what we tend to do is to, there's this story that reinforces the grief over and over again. Mm-hmm. So one suggestion is remember the love, mm-hmm. and notice, Shakespeare says, love does not alter when it alteration finds, and that includes the alteration of death. It is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. And then Shakespeare says, love bears it out even to the edge of doom. Love will take us anywhere. And so remember the love. And so that's one piece of it. And the other piece of it is, if it's possible, to a little bit to let go of the story and simply allow yourself directly to feel the grief in your body. And what happens is that if we really open to that emotion, to that feeling, and especially feeling it in our bodies, then there's a way in which eventually it moves through. There may be some lingering sadness, but the rawness of grief passes away. There's just one suggestion about working with this, and that is that if you're willing to feel the grief in your body, and I was about to go there in this talk, is that if it's a very powerful feeling, it's important for us just to touch into it and then step away from it. Touch in and step away. Because we can feel the experience of grief in our bodies, and we can get lost in it, and then that just re-traumatizes us, and it just strengthens the grief. So it's really important for us to touch in and to feel it, but not to get lost in it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because I seldom even think about it. It was 17 years ago.
Yeah.
But as you're speaking, it's like it all came back.
Yes.
The feelings, the emotions.
Right.
All came back to me. and then the memories came back
right.
as you were speaking.
Yes.
But I don't think of it every day. I hardly ever think of it anymore. Unless I look at their pictures and I blow them
yeah.
a kiss, you know.
Yeah. Lovely. Beautiful.
So that's kind of where I am. But as I say, when you were talking, it brought up those old, old feelings from way
right.
back. And I had to interrupt you, too.
Yeah, really. I so appreciate this interruption, which is not an interruption at all, because it's really absolutely about what we're talking about. And if it's possible, and I know this is not an easy thing to do, so mostly it doesn't come anymore.
Right.
But as I was talking, it kind of stimulated the grief, and the
yes.
grief started coming.
Yeah.
Is it possible to turn toward the grief and to say, "Come a little closer. I want to know you." There's a way in which all of these feelings, you know, essentially we push them away, and when we turn toward them. And with humility, say, please come closer. I want to feel you, and I want to know you, and I want to understand you. What do you have to teach me? And grief can teach us immensely if we're really willing to turn toward it and to touch it. But you know, that's not what our culture tells us. You know, maybe, I hope it didn't happen, but maybe a friend of yours said, "Oh, your son's been dead for 6 months. Can you get over it?" You know, which is it. And essentially, that's the voice of denial.
Yes.
You know, we get over it when we get over it. The heart heals at its own speed. You know, and so it's the image that has been so powerful for me, that really has been sustaining to me. And actually, a couple of my Vipassana teaching friends hate for me to tell this story, which they because of the yuck factor. But what really sustains me and keeps me engaging painful feelings is the conversion story of Francis of Assisi, Saint Francis. He was well prepared when this moment happened. He had been kind of worked before this moment happened, but it was this shifting. It was the great shifting that happened. To Francis, he came from a wealthy family. He was riding on his horse in his finery, and there was a leper by the side of the road begging. And Francis was touched with compassion, and he leaped off his horse and he kissed the leper's wounds. And he never looked back. And for me, that is such an amazing image, is that are we willing, you know, with ourselves, but also with each other, to kiss the wounds. And mostly we're not. You know, it's that rare person, and we can remember every one of them in our lives, who are willing to be totally there with our pain, to be present, to be open, to be connected, and not to turn away from our pain. And if those people are absolutely precious resources, and every one of us can become that resource. And you see that essentially what happens, if we're willing to turn toward the pain, if we're willing to come right up to it and to touch it, if we're willing to be humble and to learn what it has to teach us, you know, then actually there's this profound deepening of our practice. And there's an amazing confidence that comes. You know, wow, I went through that. You know, I can go through anything if I went through that. You know, there's this amazing kind of courage and confidence that comes from the willingness to turn toward to something and to engage it and to find out ultimately it's only grief, it's only fear, it's only hatred, it's only rage, it's only envy, it's only whatever it is. And on once we've really learned on the deepest level, we realize none of this is me or mine. You know, when you know that grief is only grief, it's only a quality of consciousness. The grief you feel and the grief I feel is exactly the same grief. It's not your grief. It's not my grief. It's just a phenomenon, a condition. When we're no longer identified with it, it gets so much easier. Thank you. That's beautiful. Thanks so much for speaking up. So what I'd like to suggest we do in this next week, if you choose to come back next week. Next week we're going to be talking about equanimity. The talk is about peace at the end, equanimity. But what I'd like to do is suggest is that we continue the work that we did this past week, that is opening to forms of happiness, seeing goodness when you see it, figuring out how to relate skillfully to pleasant experience. But also, I skipped a whole piece. That's all right. I'll do it next week. I didn't do the transpersonal part. But if you're willing to do it, really open to pain, open to physical pain, open to emotional pain, not only your own pain, but are you willing to open to the pain of others? You know, and are you willing to open to the pain of the world? I mentioned last week that I've gone through this enormous shift in my understanding of the external world by finally coming out of denial about global warming and what it's doing to this planet and the massive suffering that's on its way because of global warming. You know, and what it has taken is my turning toward it and saying, okay, let me face this reality. And going through the grief and the anger and the fear and all the rest of it and just really feeling those feelings and coming to this place of realizing, okay, I've worked through most of the feelings. Now I can be helpful. You know, when the shit comes down, I will be there trying to help. But if I'm caught up in my reactive emotions, I can't be helpful. Does that make sense? So, you know, open, see if it's possible to open to pain and notice if you can make a choice. You know, it's of course you'll resist it, both physical pain and emotional pain. Of course the resistance will come, but you can just see it for what it is, and then make a decision. Do I want to continue the old patterns that will keep me in misery forever, or do I want to find a different way of responding to unpleasant experience? Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay, so we'll gather back here in a week for those of you who choose to come next week. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.